The Parenting Unpacked podcast is recorded on Yuggera and Yugambeh Bundjalung land. We acknowledge the Turrbal, Yuggera and Kombumerri people as its traditional custodians. We acknowledge all First Peoples of this land and celebrate their enduring connections to country, knowledge and stories. We pay our respects to the elders, those who have passed into the dreaming, those here today and those of tomorrow.
Hello and welcome back to Parenting Unpacked. You're here with Dr. Kristen Summer and Dr. Siobhan Kennedy Costantini. Except you're not actually here with Siobhan right now because although we recorded an intro and an outro, in addition to an entire interview with a wonderful guest, my mic decided to have a million audio issues. And I made it my mission for season two that we would not have the same technical difficulties that resulted in nightmare listens, especially for the sensory averted like me. So I just spent the last hour of my life at 7 a.m. on Monday morning, when this goes live at Tuesday, editing out all of my statements in our interview and replacing them with voiceovers. So if it sounds a little bit disjointed, that might be why. I've done my best, but you know, no one's perfect. But because of that, there was no way I was going to do our intro and our outro as well, because we talk forever and the interview was already going to be 50 minutes long. So instead, you have my voice in your ears to introduce you very briefly to what we're talking about today. So who we're talking to today is Sarah R. Moore from Dandelion Seed Positive Living. That's her Instagram handle. But more importantly, she's the author of the book called Peaceful Discipline. It's actually a book I've seen in bookstores before. Now, this is a really interesting episode because it's all about, she calls it peaceful parenting, gentle parenting, whatever you want to call it. It's all about this idea of interpersonal neurobiology. She's been trained by Dan Siegel. She's been trained by Vesa Vanderholt, who does trauma-informed therapy kind of stuff. And Siobhan fangirls because she loves Vesa Vanderholt's, I think that's how you say it, book, The Body Keeps the Score. And she's been trying to tell me to read that book for such a long time. And I keep telling her that I'll get around to it and I'm not that interested. But after talking to Sarah, in like the space of like a minute, Sarah has convinced me to do what Siobhan's been trying to make me do for months. So anyways, here is the wonderful Sarah, who speaks so calmly and beautifully and with that lulling American accent that we all love. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you at the bottom end of the episode.
Okay, hello. We have the wonderful Sarah here from Dandelion Seeds Positive Living. That's your handle, right?
Yes, my Instagram handle. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us all the way from the land of the Americas. And I will throw it to you. Do you want to tell us a bit about who you are, what you do, who you're a mum to, all those fun things?
I'd be happy to, yes. So as you mentioned, I am the founder of Dandelion Seeds Positive Parenting, or in Instagram world, Dandelion Seeds Positive Living, because the word parenting wouldn't fit. The founder of that, I am the author of Peaceful Discipline, Story Teaching, Brain Science, and Better Behavior. I am a board member for the American Society for the Positive Care of Children, and I am a master trainer of conscious parenting with my own training in everything from child development to interpersonal neurobiology, trauma recovery, to improv comedy. And perhaps the last one might be the most important for parenting, because I certainly use that every day. And I am a real life parent above and beyond everything else to a child who I have to know how to parent. And I have to coach people around the world who are parenting actual children as well. So I believe it's the real world experience that is the best training of all, of course. And I'm very thankful to be here with you today.
Amazing. And I have so many questions already, but because we're a little bit of an education nerd, why don't you tell us about your training, your background?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have, gosh, I actually spent almost 20 years in corporate America. So reality is I'm 200 years old. I just look young for my age.
Yeah. Love it.
But I spent about 20 years in corporate America where I was in communications and negotiation and persuasion, all sorts of things like that, that I absolutely did not realize were perfect training for parenting because we use all of these skills, right? And in my spare time, because I needed some balance in my life, I went to improv comedy school at night. And that's where I got the improv thing going on. Well, lo and behold, fast forward 20 years, I had my daughter. And I was once in a pediatrician's office. By the way, I have moved on to another pediatrician who was much better informed than this guy was. But in that initial meeting, he looked at me and said, by the way, make sure to never pick up your child when she cries because she's manipulating you. Well, she was only 4 months old at the time. I froze and I thought, how ridiculous is this? Of course I'm going to be responsive. She's a baby. And I responded with something to that effect, you know, but in a much more polite manner, but basically said, I thought it was good to pick up our children. And he told me to let him know when I was ready to get serious about parenting. So
my goodness,
a fire lit in my belly that day, and I decided to get very serious about parenting. So that's when I went on to study everything I could to help empower other parents and caregivers, everything from attachment with Dr. Daniel J. Siegel to the trauma recovery piece I mentioned with Bessel van der Kolk, also interpersonal neurobiology with Dr. Siegel again. And I worked with quite a few leaders in child development firsthand directly. For example, a guy named Tom Hobson, many people know him as Teacher Tom, but he led an internationally recognized play-based school for young children. And also Elizabeth Cantley, who's the author of the No Cry Sleep Solution series. And I just got my hands as far into respectful, responsive parenting as I possibly could, initially for my own edification, so that I had the validation internally for indeed being responsive to my one and only real life baby. But also, the more I started studying this, the more I realized that, number one, I wanted the certifications under my belt as well. So I went and got certified in conscious parenting and became a master trainer of that. But even more importantly, it's not just about what happens here in my home. I also wanted to be able to empower other parents and caregivers so that if they ever received the inane advice like I did, that they would be able to say, no, I want something better for my child. Where can I get that? And that was really the impetus for all of the work that I do today.
Wow.
That is wonderful.
Mm. I have a question about the definition of conscious parenting, because there's so many terms, and I've been working on like a research study where we kind of try to figure out people's perceptions of these different terms and how they actually define them, because they're so variable, right? Like there's gentle parenting, there's conscious parenting, there's saran wrap parenting, there's helicopter parenting, there's so many.
I haven't heard saran wrap
parenting. Oh mate, when I asked for them on TikTok, I got hundreds of different terms. So yeah. Can you define conscious parenting, or can you verify whether conscious parenting is in line with like authoritative parenting, which is like what people, scientists like to use?
Yes, I love this question because you're right. I mean, we could make something up right now, pull it out of the air, call it a parenting style, and there would probably be something on Google by that definition. There are so many ridiculous terms out there. And reality for me is that indeed there are a lot of terms. But at the end of the day, the way that I look at it is, am I parenting for the long-term good of the relationship that I have with my child? So knowing that, and I've got a chapter in my book, Peaceful Discipline, about this, we want to be able to parent in ways that don't make us feel like jerks. We know that we need boundaries. We know that we need to lead our children in responsible ways because they need that security from us. But we also have to feel good about ourselves doing it. I don't want to go to bed at night thinking, oh, I wish I hadn't had to yell so much. Well, guess what? I don't actually have to. And I learned through all of this research that I did that it's not so much about what we call it, but it's about how the relationship feels, not only for us as a parent, but perhaps even more importantly, how our relationship is perceived by our children. Does it feel emotionally safe? Does it feel like the kind of relationship where someday our child makes a poor choice? Will they say, I'm going to run to my parent to support me and help me through this? Or will they run from us for fear of how we'll react? And I certainly want to be in that first category. So I've got blog posts about conscious parenting, but my short answer to you is, I don't necessarily care a whole lot about what people call it. If it feels good to you and it feels good to your child and you are leading responsibly in evidence-based ways, I'm going to call that a win.
Good answer.
I think that is, yeah, that's a great answer. They, there's, I need to check her name. I think she's, is it Raising Good Humans? Raising, is it Rebecca? She talks about, Raising Humans Kind on Instagram. She talks about being able to parent with a whole body yes. And I think that is speaks to exactly what you're talking about, like being able to make decisions and make calls that feel good and right in your soul, in your spirit, in your body. And it doesn't always necessarily mean that our child is happy with those choices, but that we feel safe and comfortable in knowing that we made a choice that was right for the moment. And I mean, we don't always do those. I regularly make choices that I don't love all the time, but it's about being able to repair those relationships, right? I love what you said at the beginning about improv comedy, because I remember seeing that in your bio and being like, that would be so helpful for raising small children. Because one thing that I rely on constantly in my own parenting is being able to pivot, being able to make really quick decisions, being able to not distract, but like go with wherever their energy is going and capitalize on the flow of what's happening in the moment. And all of those scream improv comedy to me. So can you tell us a bit more about how you've experienced your like kind of professional improv training and parenting?
Yes, and you just set up the perfect stage, no improv pun intended, for what it really looks like. We have to be able to pivot quickly. We have to be able to take whatever is thrown at us. And really the biggest tenet of improv comedy that we use daily is a concept called yes and. So what this comes down to in simple terms is that anytime we are faced with a situation from our child, maybe it's something great that feels good to both of us, or maybe it's something that is tricky, rather than, number one, fighting against reality and saying, oh my goodness, my child is, for example, having a great big emotional release. A lot of people call those either tantrums or meltdowns. I personally prefer emotional release because it's a reminder to myself that it's healthy to get those big feelings out. But maybe that feels messy to me, but my reality can't be, I need to stop this as quickly as possible because we're trying to get out the door. My reality needs to be, my child is really upset right now. How can I be in this moment and be supportive so that together we can move on from a place of completion and emotional safety rather than throwing a band-aid on it and hoping it just gets better? So fighting with reality never works. The flip side of yes and is that being able to roll with whatever happens in the moment and supporting our children in their development, in their play, in wherever they are. So for example, if my child says, I want to go to the playground today, and I say, oh, this is a problem because it's dinner time and it's not time to go to the playground, instead of being the, you know, combative parent who says, what are you thinking? It's too late. We can't do that. And next thing you know, you feel crummy when you say that. Your child is upset because you said no. Instead, it's all about emotional validation as well. So in this case, I might say, oh, the playground is so much fun, isn't it? That's my yes and. The playground is amazing. Right now, we're about to have dinner. But let's go look at the calendar and look for our first available day when we can go to the playground, because I'm just as excited as you are. And when we have a response like that, the child feels seen, they feel understood, they feel like we are on the same team and we're working together toward a common goal. And that is 99% battle avoidance, not because we're conflict avoidant, that's different, but because there are so many battles in life that we absolutely don't need to have when we want to have a peaceful coexistence with our family.
That is so true. I use that exactly. I use it all the time. But last night, the example was we needed, my little one had been in the shower forever and we'd both had our showers and he was like, I need to play. And we said, I know, darling, playing in the shower is so much fun. We did exactly that. I said, but we do need to turn it off. So can we work together? Can you count to 10 for me? And then we'll turn it off. And he was so excited to count to 10 with me that he kind of forgot that he was upset about turning the shower off, because we were working together to do this. Yay, counting to 10, counting so much fun. And then he's like, okay, 10, it's time to turn it off. I was like, it's magic. It feels like magic when it works.
Yes. It's absolutely brilliant. And I love that example. Sometimes the yes and is yes, and this is really hard. And I'm going to hold space for your big feelings. And one of the tools that I personally use in my own parenting, and I coach others to use it too, is to say this simple phrase, and it sounds like it's going to be trickier than it is, but I promise you it's not. Well, actually, that's sort of a trick answer. It is, but it isn't. And I'll talk about both of those in a second. But the simple phrase is, all of your feelings are safe here. And when my child is upset and she's having her big emotional release, perhaps it's about the lolly in the morning, perhaps it's about something else, but the big feelings are there regardless. When I say all of your feelings are safe here, the first person who I'm actually saying that to is myself, because it's a reminder to self to make all of her feelings safe and not try to rush them, not try to talk her out of them, but simply just to be with her while she expresses whatever she needs to express. And secondly, of course, it's a reminder to her that she gets to feel her feelings, and she knows that she can be loud or she can be sad or she can be whatever. So it's a reminder to both of us. This is the easy part that I mentioned, that little phrase, all of your feelings are safe here. The hard part is about the person who is always in the room with us, who we can't see. And who that person is my inner child. My inner child who learned, oh, big feelings are scary. Big feelings are something we don't do here. Anger is scary. Grief is scary. All of these things are too much for my nervous system. So the hard work is, as a parent, me showing up for my inner child in that moment and reparenting myself on the fly to say, actually, no, I'm an adult. I have new skills and new tools that I can use right here in this moment. I can do some belly breaths. I can do a quick meditation or a quick prayer. I can do some proprioceptive input. I've got all of these tools at my disposal that I have to remember that I can rely on, so that I don't default into my inner child understanding of the safety of these emotions, which is basically non-existent. So I need to show up for myself on the inside so that I can create that emotional safety for my child to do whatever she needs to do. That's the hard part. And that's the part that takes, honestly, a whole lot of practice.
I think that's so true. Because yes, you need to tell yourself that it's safe. But when you're in a really heightened state, when you're exhausted, when you're tired, it's so easy for your own nervous system to be overrun by the intensity of your child's feelings. That's not to put the blame at their door, but it's that that you have instinctive reactions because of everything that you've said that can be really confronting and overwhelming, and everything in your body is telling you to make it stop, which isn't necessarily healthy or helpful for our children. And it's so interesting. Both Kristen and I have 3-year-olds, and I have really noticed that my little one is exploring anger a lot more than he has previously. And it's so interesting because I've heard parenting people all over the internet talk about how it's really important to signal to our children that their anger is safe with us. And anger is an emotion that I have a lot of history with in my childhood, my inner child. But it's been really, really interesting because for both my husband and I, that's something we've talked to each other about, how we want him to feel that anger is a useful emotion and that can be done very constructively. But seeing my little one almost test the boundaries, I don't know if that's the right phrasing, but I can see in his eyes that he's checking in with me in the middle of an angry release, that like, is this okay? I'm a bit scared by this. And like just holding his shoulders, or actually no, usually he doesn't let me do that when he's in that, but like looking him in the eye, being like, it's okay to be angry. I'm here for you. And seeing the relief in his eyes is freaking wild. It happens very occasionally. Most of the time he's literally just screaming in my face. And I'm telling him it's okay to be angry. It's not okay to yell at me. And he's like, cool, not relevant to me and my story. But seeing like those inner cogs happen is really cool and weird. Anyway, that's just my personal reflection on what you've said.
Yes, I get that, you know, and you touched on something important there too. We also do get to have boundaries as parents. You know, if a child is flailing, you know, God forbid they pop us in the nose while they're mad or whatever it may be, we get to say, hitting hurts. Do this with your hands instead. You know, we get to have boundaries for personal safety, for emotional safety. We get to, although I don't advocate timeouts for children, not in a punitive way anyway, I absolutely do advocate if the parent is feeling too triggered by their child's big feelings, I absolutely do advocate, make sure the child is in a safe place and say, mommy's going to be back in 5 minutes or whatever it's going to be, or even better, translate it to something that the child can understand. In the amount of time it would take you to watch one cartoon, I will be back. I'm going to go regulate my body so that I can be a peaceful parent for you. And most children are going to say, yes, sign me up for the peaceful version of you. So it's a win-win, but it's absolutely okay to have those boundaries when you need them, because we do have this history and it's not like we can just check it at the door, as you said.
Now, we love controversial topics here at Parenting Unpacked, and Sarah, you just touched on one that I would love to talk more about, and that is time out. Can you tell us what you think about time out, how you think we should use it under the umbrella of peaceful parenting and all that good stuff?
I can, yes. And I actually go into this controversial topic as well as several others in the book. So I am right with you in being willing to go there and have these hard discussions, because honestly, if we're not talking about them, no one has the opportunity to consider that there might be an alternative if they feel like what I've been doing is the only option. So I hope it will empower people to hear that my opinion, and based on the research, is that there are two different kinds of timeouts as it relates to children. There are punitive timeouts that are effectively designed to make the child feel bad for their behavior. It's to make them feel ashamed, make them, quote unquote, think about what they've done, even though, hello, raise your hand if you remember being put in timeout and being in the corner thinking, I am so glad my parents put me here. I am coming up with a better life plan going forward. Kids don't do that, right?
So no, they don't have that.
Yeah, exactly. So there's the punitive version. And then there is a type of calming corner timeout where maybe it is a refuge for the child. Maybe it's a place where the child can go into their little tent or whatever they have to say, I have my sensory calming tools. I like it in here. I want to be in here. And I'm going here by choice rather than being made to go in here. I am in favor of the second type if it works for the child. And here's my other qualifier, if the adult, with the child's consent, with the child's agreement, if the adult will stay present enough that if the child needs or wants emotional support, the adult is right there to give it to them. I don't recommend saying, go to your calming corner, it's your happy place, I'm going to be in the other room, because that can still end up feeling like isolation. The problem, according to the research, with the truly punitive versions of timeouts is manyfold, to be honest. But in a nutshell, what we teach our children when we send them away into a punitive timeout is, number one, that we as the adult are, and I'm going to say something controversial just for you, that we as the adult don't have the skills or the resources to give them the kind of support that we need. That can actually put an unfair emotional burden on the child to go, oh, well, if they don't know what to do with my big feelings, how in the world am I supposed to know what to do with my big feelings? So it really puts them at a disadvantage. Plus, It also really denies them and us the opportunity to heal through hard things together. And if children learn too early that we are not a safe place to come to when they're struggling and that they will be sent away when they're having a difficulty of any sort, this is the child who later becomes the adult who says, I don't need anybody, I don't want anybody. When I struggle, I need to suck it up on my own. And not only do I need to suck it up on my own, but perhaps I'll even develop some unhealthy coping mechanisms because these are the only things I know how to do to make me feel better. Obviously, not every child ends up in horrific situations with really bad life choices later on. But there is a correlation between children who are repeatedly sent away and long-term shame, long-term disassociation issues, long-term disconnection, and lack of ability to have emotional stability and true deep intimacy with the people with whom they hope to have long-term healthy restorative relationships, even in times of conflict. How's that for my controversial answer?
I absolutely love your answer. I think that's bang on. And I think something that people kind of get confused about timeout with is that it can be a useful tool when used appropriately, but the majority of times it's not actually used appropriately. It's used as a way to kind of shut down the moment because the parent is overwhelmed and freaking out and they're just like, oh my God, I can't handle this. Like, go to your room. And they... Part of this problem is that parents are fed this perspective that children should be obedient and listen to their parents and be perfect all the time. But cognitive development, child development, does not follow that same kind of ideology. And that's a really big problem because when parents are told kids should act a certain way and then they don't, what happens is they see their kid as the bad kid and they see themselves as a failure, which in and of itself is a problem. But when they see their kid as a bad kid, they do what's called the Pygmalion effect. They see their kid as a bad kid, their kid behaves in a certain way, which then confirms their idea that they are a bad kid. And that attitude and behavior towards their child then tells their child, I am a bad kid, and makes them act in that way. And this cycle just keeps confirming it, rather than just a simple perspective shift of, you're not a bad kid, you're just having a hard time.
Right, and I love that you touched on confirmation bias too. Mm. You know, it is exactly what that is. I see what I expect to see. And if I think my child is a troublemaker, I am going to see a child who is a troublemaker. But if I see them as a child who's struggling, I see them as a child who needs support. And it's really the bottom line paradigm shift that we need to be thinking of when it comes to these ever so common disciplinary actions. But discipline is, by definition, supposed to mean to teach.
Yeah.
And teaching is supposed to be benevolent. It's supposed to be peaceful, hence the name of my book, Peaceful Discipline, because it's a reminder that it is supposed to be a peaceful way that we teach our children, not only in what we do, but also in how our children perceive it. Mm-hmm. And that really is the game changer here. Yeah, it really is a paradigm shift of, you know, what the child is capable of and how we can support them, knowing what they're able to do and what they're not developmentally able to do, particularly knowing that the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that thinks about consequences of actions and planning ahead and things like that, won't be developed until the child is between 25 and 30 years old. Well, many of us aren't even living at home anymore by that age. So as long as children are living with us, odds are pretty good they're going to need more support than anything. And our job is to simply model the kind of human that we want them to be by being kind, by being gentle, by being respectful, being responsive, all the things that we want them to be. It's ours to model so they have something to copy in their behavior down the road. But it takes years and years of practice to get there.
So I had a question, bit of context. I am one of five children. Kristen is one of four. I am pregnant with my second child who, in terms of our family planning, we're planning for that to be our last child. But I'm very, and this is not just what we've been talking about today, but like parenting in general, most families have one or two children nowadays. And so much of the parenting conversation and advice is about parents who are able to give one-on-one time and support their children in these really intensive ways, which I think is great and I'm all for, and that is absolutely how I parent. However, it makes me reflect a lot on my childhood about how a lot of the parenting advice that we give now, even if it were, I mean, it would have been out of the world of possibility back in the 80s and 90s, but assuming it wasn't totally woo-woo and crazy, it just wasn't possible. Like, there's just too many people, there's too many moving bodies. And I just am curious, and obviously you work with lots and lots of parents of multiple children, no doubt, how it works in those contexts of families with 3 and 4 and 5 kids.
Yes. Well, first of all, congratulations on your pregnancy. That's very exciting.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. And you're absolutely right. There are still, even in this day and age, lots of big families. I'm surprised how many I hear about on such a regular basis, because you're right, the consensus is families are getting smaller. But I still regularly hear about, you know, families with 4, 5, 6 children, and it's still happening. Reproduction is still happening. Go here. So what I often recommend that people do is focus on a couple of things. Number one is, first of all, we need to acknowledge that it is a different ballgame when we have more bodies around, because people are going to have differing needs, differing abilities, and that sort of thing. So first shift we need to make is to be gentle with ourselves and realize that we're doing the best we can with the resources we have at any given moment. And we're going to have days when we're tired, overwhelmed, have sensory overload, whatever it is. So our first obligation is to really show up for ourselves, be in touch with our own bodies and say, what do I need right now? How am I feeling? What am I needing? What do I have to offer? And some days we might have a fair amount to offer. Other days we might be totally kaput. And you know what? I have a screen to offer you all day long, child. That might just be where we are. And if that's the reality, no judgment. We are still doing the best we can with those resources or lack thereof. So grace for the self is number one. Number two is realizing that even if we have a bunch of children, generally speaking, their temperaments are going to be more or less predictable. For example, if we have a child who is more sensitive, perhaps more introverted, perhaps more hyper aware of the surroundings, maybe has, you know, a lower threshold for sensory input, that child is more or less always going to be within 10 to 20% of that baseline. Whereas another child could be the polar opposite of that. So we pretty much know who we're dealing with as we raise children. And our job then is to be proactive about not trying to meet everybody's needs simultaneously all the time, because that's a recipe for somebody being upset all the time. So instead, what we can do is be proactive to make sure that for the child who is more sensitive, for the child who is needing more downtime, be really intentional about telling them, I know that downtime is important to you, but we're going to make sure that after we go do this event today, we're going to be home from 2 o'clock this afternoon on, and it's going to be story time. And if your sibling wants to go and do this, that, or the other rambunctious thing, they can do that in the other room, but we're going to go have our quiet time, and they're welcome to join us if they want to. And then we do the opposite for the higher energy child, the more extroverted, however you want to define them. But we need to be intentional, whether that, you know, the examples that I shared are representing a single child or if they're representing these three over here and those three over there. But we want to be proactive about meeting everybody's needs so that nobody consistently gets overlooked. It's tricky as a parent because we have our own temperament too. I personally err on the side of being more introverted and, you know, quieter and that sort of thing. My child is like me, so we spend a lot of time on the couch reading stories, and that's a happy place for us. My husband would lose his marbles if he had to do that all day, every day. So we have to make sure to build in time for him too, for doing more of the activity stuff. So that works when everything is regulated. What happens when there's chaos? What happens when all of the children are crying, all of the children are screaming, all of the children are upset about things? Who do we comfort first? one of the paradigm shifts, and I keep saying paradigm shifts in our discussion, so apparently we're shifting all the paradigms today. One of the paradigm shifts that I suggest for people is, rather than thinking about who do I comfort first, instead changing the priority to something I call group co-regulation. And basically what that sounds like is, I am going to make a neutral statement that's going to be true for everybody. So it might sound like this: oh my goodness, there is so much energy in this room right now. I can tell that everybody is really needing support, period. That way, the extroverted, boisterous child is like, yes, I need some support because I'm upset about this thing. The more introverted, sensitive child — by the way, not all sensitive children are introverts, but I'm just making up a dynamic here — but that child is going to be like, yes, I agree, this is hard. But in a neutral, true statement like that, everybody feels like, oh, yes, we are acknowledging that this is a hard situation for every single one of us. And then my job as a parent is to follow that up by saying, because I know it's hard for everybody, I'm going to make sure that everybody gets taken care of. So I've got your back. I love you all. And I'm in it for the greater good. We're going to find a way to make this work for everybody. And then we go through and kind of do our triage, if you will, and see how can I, you know, handle the most chaotic situation first to get that under control before I move on to whatever is down the line. But when I start with that kind of group co-regulation, it also helps my children feel that I'm not taking sides. It helps my children feel that they all matter, as opposed to, oh, there goes mom choosing that child, you know, always prioritizing them. I must not be so important. But always start neutrally and start with the whole group dynamic and whatever tricky thing is going on, as opposed to singling out an individual child or two and leaving the rest of them for themselves. How does that land with you, coming from big families? Can you imagine?
Yeah, I can't imagine, but that's more of the family dynamic than anything else. but I totally see what you're saying. And I think the point that I was left with, that it's really, instead of jumping straight to problem solving or straight to triage, which, as you say, does need to happen in, or the, but as in that's part of it, but that just taking that beat to be like, this is hard. Everyone's having a hard time. Let's work through it together. Like, switching it into, instead of I'm the problem solver that's going to come in and fix down the line, which automatically creates like lots of little dyads, keeping everyone in that kind of group mindset, it makes complete sense to me, in theory. Obviously, there will be screaming people and it will be terrible in its own special way, because that's the dynamic of chaos. But setting those intentions, even especially for yourself as the parent, is hugely helpful.
Exactly, yeah. And I talk in the book specifically about a process that I call the HUG process. And the HUG is really just an acronym. H stands for hold your reaction. U is understand the child or the children's perspective. And then the G is give them grace to be human. And I outline it very specifically in, you know, more detail about how that works. But the H is really the hold your reaction is the part that's so easy to overlook, yet so important, especially in group dynamics, because oftentimes it feels like the house is on fire when really it's just my nervous system on fire. And if I can pause and regulate myself, then I can show up more effectively, regardless of whether I'm parenting one child or 100 children, God forbid, right?
100, no thank you, pass.
Okay, so autistic brain wants literal practical applications of this group dynamic, mostly because I'm going to need it as well. Both about to have newborns, and when they're both screaming and one of them doesn't have the cognitive capacity to be told there's lots of energy room, they need support and won't for about 2 years, what do we do? How do we fix it?
Yeah, it's such a brilliant question. So this is where it's especially important to be checking in with ourselves and being proactive knowing that even in the moments of, even if it's few and far between, in the moments of peace and the moments of calm, we take note of those and we relish those moments of peace and calm and say, you know what, this is contributing to my overall well-being, and I'm going to have this to carry forward into the next dynamic before it gets tricky, so that when it gets tricky again, I have something from which to draw. And it also means I need to be really extra intentional about creating as many peaceful moments as I can possibly influence, or I dare say control. I know we can't really control anything, but if I know that perhaps I'm low on sleep one day, I'm tired, I'm more likely to be grouchy, therefore I'm more likely to be reactive to whatever chaos might be happening outside of me, that might be a day where I check in with myself and say, I know that I have very few resources today. So what I am needing is, I don't know, I'll pull something out of the air. I'm needing simplicity. So maybe for me, it's what can I take off my plate today? Maybe I'm picking up dinner instead of cooking that meal that I was planning to cook tonight. Maybe I am allowing more screen time than I typically do, because that way I can just sit on the couch and chill for a little longer. Maybe I can just do whatever little steps I can take to be proactive, so that when things do go sideways, because unfortunately they will at some point, you at least have some go-tos in your own mind, so that you know I was intentional about creating something, so it doesn't catch me so off guard when it happens. And for me personally, as far as really tangible things, when I'm feeling dysregulated, I forget all of my best laid plans. So I will literally go and have a list written down. I might stick it in a drawer, maybe have it up on my fridge. I will go, oh, what are some things I can do right now to help myself regulate or help make today easier? And then I know I can always go check my list, even if I feel like I can't remember a thing in the moment. And how does that support you?
Yes, I think that is probably the correct solution, even though, like, I want a quick fix. I know that that's just not, there is no quick fix for this kind of thing, because we shouldn't stop the crying because it's weighing on us. We are the adults with the developed prefrontal cortex, the capacity for self-regulation, and our kids learn how to self-regulate by co-regulating with us. And I get that. So, like, I don't want to use the phrase, you should fill your cup, but that's kind of what this idea is. And the reason I don't want to use that phrase is because autistic, like, I am a literal thinker, and as much as I understand these phrases, they still annoy the crap out of me, because the first thing I think is the visual, which I then have to push aside and then think about what it means, which is just cognitively exhausting and is counterintuitive to, you know, filling my cup. So I think you're really right that what we want to do is, in those moments of calm and quiet, we want to bank our self-regulation capacities. We want to make sure that we're not overwhelming our bodies and things like that. We want to rest when our child is napping, not do housework. I think all those things are really, really important. So yes, it's not a quick fix. And that's going to make me annoyed and lots of other people annoyed. But I think it's a really great idea and a really great shift in perspective from just trying to, like, white knuckle. Is that what it's called? White knuckling your way through life. And just hoping that, you know, eventually the kid stops being so hard. Instead of that, it's caring for yourself in the moments when you can, so that when you can't, you are more equipped to handle it.
Yes, absolutely.
And I have an awesome question that ties in beautifully with what you've just shared, Kristen. But so, as Kristen touched on, we both have, so Kristen's little one is more highly sensitive. My little one would have been classified as highly sensitive as a baby, but he had a lot of gut health issues and probably is now more of a slow to warm little one, but definitely on the more challenging as to parent temperament sides. And obviously your handle speaks to temperament, and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then in the beginning, when you were talking about your training, you said that you've worked with Bessel van der Kolk, who is amazing and wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score. And I just am, one thing I'm really working through in this pregnancy and hoping to take forward through to the next postpartum is processing how my body has stored a lot of that trauma from that first postpartum. And I'm doing lots of like sensory stuff and planning stuff. And wanted to talk to you a bit about, like, obviously a lot of what we've talked about is kind of how to handle older kids who we're able to have these conversations with. But when we're being bombarded, for want of a better term, with the intensity of a newborn who is of a more sensitive temperament, what are some things we can do to help regulate ourselves and help them regulate their nervous systems?
Brilliant question. And I feel that one deeply too, because I share some of that experience as a parent with a highly sensitive newborn back in the day. But first thing we have to remember is that our own trauma, our own stress, our own fight or flight is not coming from the prefrontal cortex. It's not coming from the rational part of our brain where talk therapy tends to benefit it most. Talking will help. Having shared experiences, learning tips and tools you can use going forward, that all is helpful, and I do recommend it. And good news, bad news, it's not enough. Because when you have this stored stress in your body, it is more likely to have been stored in your limbic system, which is not the part of the brain that is rational and thinking about the future and all of the things we keep touching on. It is simply a body storage system of feelings, emotions, all of the things that you have ever processed, good and bad and otherwise. So if you, and I talk about this a little bit in the book too, if you have a body issue, you also need a body solution. So I love that you said that you are doing some of the sensory work and that sort of thing, but for you, it may be more helpful to find ways to create as much safety in your body as you possibly can. It may be something where you need to develop some in the moment calming tools for your body, where you're not simply trying to talk yourself out of your stress, but instead say, okay, body, I can tell I'm really activated right now. I can tell I'm really triggered. I am feeling fight or flight or freeze or fawn or any of the other varieties that people talk about these days. So what I need right now might be, in fact, this is a perfect analogy for newborns. I'm taking my hand right now and I'm putting it on my neck where I have my skin exposed. We talk about skin to skin contact for babies as far as heart rate regulation and body temperature regulation and that sort of thing. As it turns out, skin to skin works for adults too. So right now with my hand on my own neck, I'm giving myself skin to skin contact. It helps calm my nervous system and go directly to the limbic area of my brain where I've been storing my stress. I can give myself a big squeeze, like I'm hugging myself. I can give myself that proprioceptive input. This mimics the feeling of safety that I had back in the womb. I don't consciously remember being in my mother's uterus, but my body remembers that that's what safety felt like before I came out into this sometimes not so safe world. But when I can access feelings of safety through my body, these are things I can do anytime, anywhere, and they can help ground me so that I don't just catch myself in a situation where I'm trying to talk myself out of being stressed because the rest of my body isn't ready to listen when I'm feeling in that way. You can also be proactive and do things like somatic dance therapy, you know, EMDR. There are so many other modalities available that really help release that trauma from the inside out so that when you are in that situation of holding a crying newborn again, you aren't holding the same newborn that you were holding with your first child. And more than that, you're not being the crying child that you once were that your body is holding on to if you haven't effectively found a way to release it. So it's pretty cool stuff when you think about all the things our bodies are capable of that have nothing to do with talking ourselves out of our feelings.
I love that answer, and it speaks to so much of what I've been working on, because I must have been about a year ago now, I read Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, and I was like, ah, that's why talk therapy is helping, but not really tapping into so much of the stuff because I definitely had this sense, because we were talking about negative cognitions and I'm like, I don't have very many of those. Like, I just feel my body respond and I don't want it to, and I can yell at it for responding, but it doesn't do anything. I've tried that strategy, that doesn't work. And it was the thing that kind of really clinched it, and I've talked about this before, is that sirens were a huge thing because we lived on a really busy road and it would wake my baby and then the baby would scream and then it would just create this terrible. And so anytime there was a siren or a motorcycle revving, I would just get this whole body shut down. And it wasn't until my little one started, he was about like a year or 2 years old, maybe 18 months, he started to love emergency vehicles. And it was that reprogramming of him being so excited every time he heard a siren that I was like, oh, this is all body-based stuff. And I haven't heard of somatic dance therapy, and I'm definitely going to check that out because that sounds amazing. But I'm working with an occupational therapist who is being publicly funded through our healthcare system, which is amazing, to do a lot of this stuff. So I find what you're talking about wonderful, and I like that. Anyway, that, again, my musings on what you've shared. Kristen, take it away.
I'd love to know what you think of your diet. I've done it and I find it immensely helpful.
Awesome. I'll see if we have any available. I don't know. So we live in Brisbane, Australia. It tends to be a bit slow on the uptake on these more aggressive things. But Kristen lives on the Gold Coast, which is an hour away. I always say we live in Brisbane. We don't live in the same place.
We live close enough.
We do.
We're not across different countries, like Sarah. So
no, exactly.
That's fine. But
Brisbane's lovely. Honestly, the air is lovely. And for what it's worth, I've been taking my classes on Zoom. So if you don't mind getting up at like 2 a.m. your time, you're welcome to join me. It's all good.
This is so, of course, we live in post-COVID land. I've completely forgot about that. So that's I can so take international classes.
And I think that is the perfect note to end on. So Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
This is a joy, and I'm so glad to meet you both.
I hope you enjoyed that awesome chat with Sarah from Dandelion Seed Positive Living and the author of Peaceful Discipline. We really loved talking to her, Siobhan more so than me, but that was because in the original outro, I started by saying Siobhan and then complaining about how she's been conning me into having therapy sessions that make me a better human and make me process my trauma and, you know, my issues by booking guests that just are entirely enlightening. And I told her off for a little while. She tried to defend herself, but she's been the one booking our guests. So I think she has an ulterior motive. She says she doesn't, but I think she does. So while I was begrudgingly listening and agreeing with everything, which is usually how I respond in therapy, I don't just like to like accept things straight up and be like, oh, that's a wonderful idea. I like to like resist it and, you know, fight it for a little while, even though I know it's correct and it's excellent. But it was a really great chat. Sarah uses some visual like imagery, which for literal thinkers like me is a little bit harder to do because yes, I understand what different euphemisms mean, like inner child. And I know they're not referring to an actual child inside of you. But that's where my brain goes, and it's always a little more effort for me to like push away that visual literal interpretation and then translate it into what it actually means. I have been told that this is an autistic thing, which doesn't surprise me at all. That's my challenge. And I had this conversation with my husband after this episode to be like, what do you think of when someone says inner child? And he's like, that, you know, they're trying to deal with their past self. And I'm like, oh, because like I see a small version of the person inside their body. And that's really hard an image to push away and actually think about the next thing. And he thought that was hilarious. So anyways, this episode was really wonderful. If you are like me and a literal thinker, it might have been a slightly more challenging episode to process and listen to. You might be a bit more tired, but acknowledge that that's okay. And know that in a world where your brain doesn't function the way others does, that means you need more rest and you need more time to bank that calm, that processing before you re-engage with activities in the world. how we do this as busy humans with tiny humans depending on us, I'm still not perfect at. I'm still trying to figure that out myself. But I'm trying to carve away moments of self-care where I can. And I hope you do too. So anyways, thank you for a beautiful, wonderful episode with Sarah. I hope you enjoy this one. We have no idea what we're recording for next week, so you will be probably as surprised as we are about the next episode. But we'll catch you in that one. And thank you for hanging out, putting up with us, and dealing with the chaos. Bye.